Chucho Valdez on piano, and the Afro-Cuban Messengers with his tribute to the late Joe Zawinul, the legendary composer, bandleader, and keyboardist who literally changed the way music sounds with his technological innovations. Chucho, too, is a legend, the son of African music legend Bebo Valdez. This tune is titled Zawinul's Mambo, and it is from Valdez's 2010 release, Chucho's Steps. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And I got headed off at the pass, it seems. I was going to report to you today about this teacher's strike in West Virginia. And the thrust of the story would have been that they were entering day 9 of a walkout over pay. But they probably sensed that I was going to talk about them. So they hurried up and settled the state of West Virginia. In West Virginia, they came to an understanding, it seems. Now, I just want to go through this because it is symbolic, it's a significant thing having to do with the tone the administration, the Trump administration, has set. So, the teachers walked out. It would have been their ninth day, ninth straight school day, because they were demanding a pay raise. They hadn't received one in 4 years. And it happens that West Virginia is one of the lowest pay grades for teachers in the country. So they started off with a grumble, and then the state legislators didn't seem to pay much mind to it. They thought, well, you know, they'll calm down. They didn't calm down, and they kept pressing, and they kept getting more and more support. What were they demanding? They were demanding a 5% pay raise, 5%. The governor had agreed to it. The state Senate had agreed to it. But yesterday, some members of the state Senate, wanting to make a point, said that they can't afford a 5% pay raise. You'll have to take 4%. And talks broke off. And ostensibly, as of yesterday, the strike was back on with a concurrent attempt to come to some agreement today. Well, they did have meetings today, and not too long ago, it was declared that they had reached an agreement. What is the agreement? They will get their 5%. However, however, this is not something necessarily great news, because it's what's going to happen if they're going to get their 5%. They're going to get their 5%. However, the money is going to come from somewhere. And in typical Trumpian fashion, the money is going to come from the general services budget. They'll have to come up with $20 million, supposedly, to cover this 5% raise for the teachers. So they'll take the money out of the general services budget and, surprise, Medicaid. Now, let's take a look at this. The difference between 4% and 5% is 1%. And for 8 days, actually. They didn't go through the full 9th day. They couldn't figure out how to bridge a 1% difference between what the teachers were demanding, their 5%, since they hadn't been paid, given a raise in 4 years, and the state's position that, well, we can't give you what you're asking. So the best we can do is 4%, take it or leave it. This, to me, is a very clear signal about how bureaucracies in the era of Donald Trump will be dealing with people who, like the teachers here, certainly by contract. I mean, they're covered by a contract, a renewable contract, and to my mind, a 5% raise over to cover 4 years of not getting a raise, and the fact that these teachers are the lowest paid in the country. It would seem not to be unreasonable to find a way to get that 1% that they were asking. In other words, they were not making outrageous demands. Even with a 5% raise, they won't match the average salary of teachers across the country. They still will remain at the bottom rungs of salaries. So somebody's out to make a point. You're not going to get 5. We'll give you 4. Take it or leave it. But then they saw the outpouring of support for the teachers, indicating that the teachers weren't walking into these negotiations unsupported. The people were with them. And it seemed to me that if a bureaucracy could go through these lengths, I mean, it's not like the teachers want 10% or 15%. They're not asking for that. They're asking for 5. And if it were really impossible to meet the 5, why would you say, well, we could give you 4, but not 5? I mean, what's the difference? So now what they've decided to do, this is a political tactic, is to say, we're not only going to give the teachers 5%, the 5% they're asking for, we are going to give all state workers 5%. However, the money is going to come from somewhere. And the money is going to come out of the general services budget, which means, you know, things like garbage pickup, sanitation, these kinds of things, general services. And we're going to cut Medicaid. So it's a kind of no-win situation. You're happy that for once, you know, the teachers are winning. They deserve a good salary. They certainly don't deserve to be at the bottom rung of the national pay scale as teachers. But the vengeance of the state was visited upon them very quickly. And now the teachers are going to have to live with the fact that their raise not only caused a general pay raise across the board, but it is now coming at the expense of the poor. See, this is how they work it. It's disgusting, but this is how they do it. Now, we should feel happy, it seems, for the teachers, and I do. I was a shop steward. I understand how union issues go. But I don't think, A, it would have made that big a difference when the negotiations were on to meet the teacher's demands and get it over with. You're fussing, you're fighting, and you're holding out for 9 days so as to deny them that 1% you think they don't deserve. You'll give them four, not a penny more than that. And these are the people who are charged with, These are the people who are charged with educating the future of our country. Could you imagine that? And this is the way that the state chooses to show its appreciation for all kinds of things. That they went without raises for 4 years, and their demand isn't at all outrageous. But just to let people know who's boss and what day it is in Trump world, they're saying, we'll give you what we want to give you, not a penny more. You'll take it. And then we will make extra points for ourselves by raising salaries across the board for state employees. Now, I'm not opposed to raising salaries for anybody. I say go for it. If you can afford to pay people across the board 5%, all state employees, great. I'm concerned, though, at the politics of it, of saying you'll get your 5%, and now we'll take it out of the hide of those on Medicaid. Now, why is this significant? On the one hand, you could say, well, this was a labor negotiation that eventually turned out okay. But that's not why it's significant. It's significant because the state apparatus, even though the governor himself had approved of the 5% raise, and many in the state legislature also backed the approval by the governor of the 5% raise. We have these forces, these political forces, who can't stand the idea of people getting what they deserve. They can't stand the idea that people are able to make a living. They can't stand the idea of anybody being happy with their jobs. They intend to make your life miserable. So they put these people through the ringer for 8 straight school days, going into 9, getting all obsessed about 1%, finally giving in, but now the way we are supposed to see it as the public is that the teachers now are causing the state to pay all other state employees the same rate. So if the teachers had not made a demand, if they had only accepted their 4%, the state would not now be burdened with paying everybody 5%. And that causes great distress for the Trumpian forces in bureaucracies all across the country. You would note, of course, the significance is also they can't find money from their own salaries as legislators. That money cannot be found to bridge the gap. They're not volunteering their salaries. They're not volunteering to put a cap on their salaries. They're saying, okay, we are going to implement your demand for a raise, and it's a very modest raise. But The money is going to come out, in effect, is going to come out of your pocket as taxpayers. We, the legislators, the people who are entitled to earn a decent living, who are entitled to benefits, and who are entitled to all kinds of services, free services from the state by virtue of the offices we hold, we are not part of the budget cuts. The Medicaid folks are going to be part of the budget cuts. And they will have to thank you. So now they're pitting people, working people, against working poor and working class people. This is how brilliant these legislators are at balancing budgets and showing good leadership. So when you tally it all up, they'll tell you the story is that, okay, we've solved a problem. We have headed off a catastrophe because the teachers looked as if they were preparing to go the long haul and their support was growing. Union support, parent support, community support, because they had already made sacrifices for 4 years. And it seemed as if the bureaucracy said, well, if you can stand it for 4 years and without a big deal, you can go another four perhaps before we come to this matter of how we compensate you for maybe 8 years of not having any raises at all. This is the kind of heartlessness that we are seeing all across the country, and particularly in education. The one place you would think that people would not want any kind of upheaval or uproar or discontented individuals, because historically, teachers are valued. They're valued individuals. Nobody wants to put a teacher's nose to the grindstone and make them suffer. The country supposedly takes great pride in the fact that A, it has one of the best education systems in the world, and naturally B, the people who deliver educational services are valued. No, not now. And this is going to start, it's going to have a cascading effect across the country. So teachers better ramp up their fighting power, and communities, especially communities of color, have to be very, very aware of the mindset that prevails in education. We've seen this already with Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, having entirely different ideas about what education should be and what teachers should be, what the whole process should be. Schools are literally shutting down at accelerated rates and moving into very fierce privatization with the charter school effort, commodifying children's futures. In fact, one of the plans under the charter school program is to have no teachers in the classroom at all. Put some computers, put some kids behind those computers, and let them study based on a predetermined module for which teachers, a human presence is not really important in the classroom. That's where they're going. So pay attention to this story, because it is confirming, at least to my mind, it is confirming the way under the Trump administration, the things that they're doing. And here's what's especially important to pay attention to. West Virginia is not exactly a bastion of diversity. So you can say if they're treating or they're prepared to play hardball over one percentage point in a raise that you haven't received for 4 years, if they're prepared to come to this whole process of education with that attitude and mindset, and that they're going to take the so-called increased expense of education out of the hide of the poor, you see what the mentality is. You don't have to ask any questions about how poor school districts are faring under a situation like this. You don't have to ask that. They are raiding the poor. By the way, the teachers also are poor. They're raiding the poor to pay the poor, to perform a job that they say they value. There's no value. They have no value of these kinds of careers and functions that people are performing. In this most advanced, and we keep getting that all the time, how advanced we are in the area of education, which is a big joke. That couldn't possibly be true. This is how they are commodifying the entire process of education, so that the teachers are miserable, the administrators are miserable, the children are miserable. And the one thing that the legislators are not prepared to do is to give up any of their bennies. They'll take it out of the hides of the poor. Pay attention to this in West Virginia. It's coming to a school district near you. The good thing to report here is that although it was not anticipated or expected, the teachers put up one hell of a fight. Even though they still remain, comparatively speaking, in the same economic place. But the idea that they put up a fight to protect their rights, that was definitely a good thing. Because they're not accustomed to doing this kind of stuff. They're not accustomed to having to go on strike and leave these children out of the classrooms, and the school is shut down all across the state. They never intended to cause this much trouble. But the state carefully calculated that these are people who are decent, and they don't want to do anything really so disruptive that it would cost the children that they're trying to educate a great inconvenience. They don't want to do these things. That's not the way things are done in their neck of the woods. Schools are truly integrated into the community as part of community life. And not as diverse as you would think, as you would want, which is a whole different story. But You have here a system that has been accustomed to working in a particular way, not expecting that with this president and his supposedly highly competent administration, it would come to this. And that the state legislature insists on moving in his direction rather than showing some degree of leadership here. This thing should not have gone on for 8 days and going into the ninth day, and you're fussing and fighting and carrying on over one percentage point. And when you do agree to what had been agreed to before, agreed to and signed off on by the governor, just to show people that there's a new sheriff in town and there will be no freebies except for them. Nothing is coming out of the hide of the state legislators and their budgets, but it will be coming out of the hide of working people and the poor. So now we are set with, for them, this new paradigm that everybody was not doing economically well, but they may do. Now there's dissension. People on Medicaid who will now be denied many of their benefits are going to wag the finger of blame not at the state Senate, not at the legislators, but at the teachers. Because for them to get their 5%, it means that Medicaid has to be cut. And that's not true. It is just that you're dealing with some vicious, nasty people who resent the idea that anybody should be paid, except them, anybody but them, should be paid appropriately. When you start off from the point of view that you're earning less than most teachers in the United States, you have to live too. You have to run a household. You have children to take care of, many of them. And this is the mindset that we will now have to be prepared to receive as pervasive. This is going to be a pervasive attitude. Wherever they could make the poor pay, they will do so and make it hurt. It is the Trumpian way. Okay, so there we are. Now we're going to take a break, come back to another subject. But before I go to break, I want to remind you that Sunday is the big day. We're going to be meeting up with each other and seeing each other's voices on Sunday. I'm going to be giving a talk at the Community Church of New York. It's at 40 East 35th Street off of Park Avenue, and I'll be there at 1:30 p.m. I would love to see your face in the place. So make point of it. 40 East 35th Street off of Park Avenue. It's the Community Church at 1:30 p.m. And all of the lead stories folks are going to be in the house. Let's plan on it. We'll take this break and come right back to another subject right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And I just wanted to know whether you thought Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who keynoted the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee's convention in Washington, D.C., and President Trump, his gracious host at Blair House, whether they appreciated the irony of the moment. Do you think? Did you? We have these two extraordinary leaders meeting each other and under some very interesting circumstances. Why don't you help us understand why it was an ironic moment? 888-874-4888. What was the irony that probably slipped by quite a few people, that here you have the prime minister of what he calls the Jewish state meeting with such our wonderful president and having a great moment? What went through your mind as the two met and talked all that talk? What should we be paying attention to in that meeting of all these wonderful photographs and photo ops and speeches being made and so forth? At the root of it, what did you glean from the great historic moment? 888-874-4888. Let's see whether you picked that up or not. I tell you, if this were scripted by a comedian posing as a historian, it couldn't even be better. This was just a unique moment. Let's put it that way. A very unique moment that these paths crossed at that time in Washington, D.C., where the occasion was to address what they call a public affairs committee, addressing the interests of the Jewish state and the president of the free world, Donald Trump. Did you find anything odd about that meeting? Did you see anything that caused you even just to shake your head and say, well, this is what things have come to? This is what we are supposed to look to and regard as the very best of leadership? Two men who epitomized such leadership. What are your thoughts? I see you're reluctant today. 888-874-4888. Let's hear from you. Who's up? Oh, my. Nobody's up. You're getting kind of reluctant here. I thought you were going to run for this and tell us exactly what we should have thought of the moment. But apparently you're kind of shy. But I don't want to address it myself. I want you to address it. So I'm going to wait for you to tell us what we should have gleaned from that moment, when the pictures were taken and we saw the two heads of state commiserating and having very nice diplomatic times with each other. Jose from Rosedale, you're on the air.
Greetings, my professor.
Hello. What should we have gleaned from that moment?
As always, ancestral blessing be upon you, always, okay?
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I think, in my humble opinion, whenever two evil minds get together, no good can come out of it. And I believe what the president, the both presidents will be, the president, prime minister will be discussing, is how much destruction they are going to be heaping down on the Palestinian people. I believe they will be discussing Iran, what the hopes and the wishes of Israel in regards to Iran. I think they'll be discussing Syria, because I see Israel as this grand plan of this greater Israel, and I see them coveting some of the land of Syria. I really think they would like to see Syria dismembered, and they acquire a piece of
this. Let me ask you to put that on hold for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And from your own personal interpretation mm-hmm. of the symbolism of the moment, what did you get out of that?
Well, the symbolism I get from it is that I see this stranglehold. Again, my humble opinion, it's showing the might, the power of the Israeli lobby and the political system in this and economic system in this country. And I think there's a discussion will be taking place about mutual interest, mutual business interest of this president and his regime in regards to the relationship with he and the Israeli state. And there is the funding that's going to be out there to reward he and whatever he's doing to benefit and aid the state of Israel. And also Netanyahu, I believe, is trying to boost up his legitimacy as Prime Minister of Israel and to hold on to his job, because there's things coming down the pike that is detrimental to him. And I think he's boosting up his support in the Zionist community here in America. And he's cozying up to the president of the United States, and they're both cozying up to each other in their both mutual interest.
It's a very cozy kind of situation. You're onto something here, Jose. You got it started. Thank you. Patricia from New York, you're on the air. What was the symbolism of the moment?
Good afternoon, Eutrice, and good afternoon to the PRN family. What
Thank
I find
you.
Interesting at the moment is that here you have the two leaders of these two countries, both of them under serious investigations, under serious indictments in their respective countries, and then they come and present themselves as the moral leaders of the world. They need each other right now because they're both in the same boat.
Amen. You hit it on the nail. And what were you thinking when you were watching the whole orchestration of the photos?
All I could do was just shake my head. There was nothing else I could do but shake my head. Does no one else see this?
You're absolutely right. And that's what I'm saying. When the world sees something like this, they are also asking the same thing. I mean, is there something we don't know?
Yeah, well, what are we missing?
You have two heads of state, both under major investigation. And not just them, but people in their families as well. Netanyahu is under investigation. The police have already recommended indictments. His wife is under investigation.
His son? I mean, it's the whole family.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
And they come before the world as if nothing is happening, nor did convention people, AIPAC, make any comments at all, as if to say, there's nothing wrong. What's wrong? What do you think is wrong? We invited and we got the heads of state to basically give the impression that they're responding to our power. And here we have people who are so close to a jail cell. It's funny.
Well, maybe they'll be sharing the same cell.
Thank you for your call. Emilio from Delaware, what were you thinking when you saw that these pictures yesterday? Emilio, are you there? No. Okay. Let's talk to Lincoln. What were you thinking? What was the symbolism of the moment?
She just said it and have nothing else to say. It was the fact that they both are under such serious investigation, them and their families. So when she spoke, I said, I was actually going to hang up after she said what I was going to say.
She stole your thunder?
No, she said it. So there's nothing else to say. I would just be speaking just to be speaking. Okay.
But what do you also say about the coverage of it? I mean, it's one thing that you and I and regular people noticed this. This was a very significant thing looming overhead. But there wasn't very much said about it.
It says that they don't think too much of the people, and they think that the people are blind and are oblivious to what's going on.
I'm talking about media coverage.
That's what I'm saying. The fact that this went on, and like as if to say that, okay, the people won't even be concerned with that. And it shows where the media is, too, you know, that they themselves probably is oblivious to what's really going on.
But what would account, you think, for such, well, for pardon the word, but such a brazen thing to do? I mean, you know the circumstances under which this convention is being held, and still you are being asked as a prime minister of Israel to come and talk as a head of state. Don't you think that some other thoughts should have prevailed here to say, well, look, I mean, because it's not just him. It's him, his wife, his son. Could that have been avoided, or was it a reflection of the arrogance of the parties concerned?
It's that, plus it's also another ingredient, AIPAC. Power of AIPAC. If Donald Trump was, it would be a difference if he was meeting the leader of the Philippines with all the craziness he's saying. But here we had the AIPAC in the concoction. So therefore, they would tread gingerly, the news media. Hello?
Yes, I'm listening. Yeah, I'm listening to you.
Yeah. I mean, because think of Duterte of the Philippines. They wouldn't think twice about using that to defame Donald Trump. But there are other things involved when you're speaking about Israel. You know, it's the Israel factor is a little bit more tricky based upon, you know, what Israel means to the USA versus what the Philippines and Duterte means to the USA.
Do you think it had a negative effect on the perception of Donald Trump in the United States or the perception of Netanyahu in Israel?
No, I think it had a positive effect on Donald Trump because that is one sector that he probably garnered a bit, just him meeting with Netanyahu, especially in the face of the fact that most people are politically ignorant. So, you know, they are playing upon people's political ignorance. For example, when we come into, like, the situation you and PRN create for us to have dialogues like this, I think we're taking it for granted that other people are as privy as we are. You know, we are able to share such kind of a thinking, you know, and
stimulate each other. The world at large and the population at large is not having the conversations we are having. So they are oblivious to a lot of things and a lot of the intricacies, you know, of politics.
You make a set of very good points today. Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate
it. Okay, thank you.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I'm saying to myself, am I in an alternate universe here? How is it that you can have this combination still pass muster as legitimate leadership, and that the people in the United States ought to regard Donald Trump as a legitimate leader and his guest as a legitimate leader and AIPAC as a legitimate organization, choosing to present people who are under very serious criminal investigations and not seem to care about it. Very, very, very interesting the way this whole thing was orchestrated. I marveled at it. From a point of view, it was a kind of public relations coup because it legitimized Benjamin Netanyahu, who, as you know, as we've been saying, is under serious investigation. Practically his whole family is, for multiple criminal issues. Donald Trump, we know what the deal is there. We have these multiple investigations and not yet finished. We're seeing his administration fall apart. We have people obsessed not with governing, but with surviving the craziness of this administration. And they themselves wrapped up tightly in a whole bunch of criminal probes. And yet he is supposed to look very stately and very, very unconcerned about the fact that he may be prosecuted. Certainly several of his aides and people who were working with his campaign and people who were part of his administration, several of them already have come under serious punishment. And it's getting wider and wider. And yet you look at these two people and the effort made to make them look like nothing is happening. Don't worry about a thing. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hi there, Utrice. Good afternoon. And I want to say to people that on Sunday at 1:30 at the Community Church of New York, that is between Madison and Park on 35th Street downtown, you know, a very rich area there. There won't be any snow on the ground there. And all roads lead to Community Church to see you at 1:30 in the afternoon. If I may, I'd like to go back to where you started today's program about West Virginia. And I think there's a takeaway message here. And the takeaway message here is that people have to understand that those people sitting in the legislative body and the governor's chair and the courts and places like West Virginia, they don't care anything about the masses of people that live there. They work really for the corporations and the rich and powerful. If the teachers have a low rate of pay and other workers also, that is because that's the way those in power want it to be. So this should be a wake-up call for all those people that live there. I call them the little people, that these people don't work for you. Or if they did work for you, they'd have a tax system that would tax the corporations higher and tax the rich people higher and pay for the services that the people need. So this is a wake-up call for all the people that live there. Don't be mad at the people who, because they're going, they're using Medicaid and people are losing their Medicaid. That's not the problem. They're not the enemy. So people in West Virginia have to understand what's the enemy, and the main name for that enemy is corporate capitalism.
Well, thank you. Thanks, and thank you for the plug. I appreciate it. Michael from New Jersey, you're on the air, and you have a couple of minutes to go.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, and same here on my side. It's a great pleasure to talk with you.
I think, you know, they're not afraid to do these kind of things, display these kind of things, because I think the American public has been desensitized to the contradictions in society and the contradictions in politics and just the contradictions in the way society operates. And they're very confident in their ability to frame any kind of display in a way that makes these contradictions seem everydayish. And it's not like we're just meeting these contradictions now. We've had it in the Clintons. They've been under investigation, major investigations, and the contradictions go on until they don't care, until the very last minute where they're kicked out of office or something happens. So I think there's two things involved: the ability for the media to shape and frame things, and I think the media is completely infiltrated by whatever you want to call it, those who control, population control, etc., our behaviors, our perceptions, or they'd like to think they control our perceptions. And the other thing is the ability, the desensitizing over a long period of time of the public to these major contradictions, so that they're not even discussed.
I agree with you entirely. I think that is a very strong point you're making about the desensitization that has set in and has been so carefully orchestrated that we're not even aware that we're desensitized to certain things. But every now and then we should stop and say, what am I seeing here? What is going on here? This, intuitively, you should be able to say, this is kind of weird. And let me now do some more thinking as to why it strikes me as weird. We know something of the background of the situation that both Netanyahu and Trump are in. So why is it being presented as normal?
Yes, I think that's what we're talking about, that we're prepared by the media, by the constant propaganda, proselytizing. We're prepared. We've been prepared over many, many years to accept what's unacceptable, to make it normal.
Well, thank you, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. Thanks. Great to hear from you today, Michael. That brings us to the end of our program today. Thank you so much for your reactions and your input. And stay tuned for The Infectious Myth with David Crowe coming right up. We'll meet up again with each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.